Welcome to Behind the Scrubs, an original podcast series produced by UT Arlington's College of Nursing and Health Innovation. I'm Aspen Drew, the manager of Conn High's Center for Rural Health and Nursing, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Jeff Taylor, Conn High's Director of Advising in the Office of Enrollment and Student Services. Hey, Jeff.
Aspen, what's happening? Every time I feel like I want that to rhyme and it doesn't quite. I want to say like Aspenin, what's happening? I don't know. We'll work on it. We got a workshop.
Yeah.
So we've done a few of these. I got to get it figured out there. We need the thing. We've got to have that worked out there.
I feel like it could work though.
Yeah, it probably could. But just Aspenin is probably not.
It's not it.
Not short. It's not short for any of that. Okay. So what's the latest with you?
Not really much, honestly. I've just been working on our conference stuff.
I've heard about this a little bit.
Yeah.
Y'all have a date set yet?
We do. So it'll be our third annual Rural Health Conference here at UTA, and it will be October 23rd and 24th. So we're super excited. The 23rd will just be a networking event, so people have, you know, the day to travel in and then get some networking done at night. And then the 24th is the actual conference, and we're going to be focusing on rural healthy people 2030. So
what goes into networking at a conference exactly?
I mean, it's really just meeting people that are in your profession, right? Or are into, specifically for us, you know, who work in rural health in any capacity, right? So they could be educators, they could be, you know, RNs in rural communities, they could be CNOs, they could be with different rural health organizations from around the country. So the National Rural Health Association, the NRHA, or TORCH here in Texas. That's kind of the normal audience. So just talking to different people who you might not have met before and have kind of a different idea, but we're all working in the same field and all working for the betterment of rural health.
Okay, that sounds fun.
Speaking of fun, what are we talking about today, Joe?
Oh, man, this is a good one. Yeah, we have an actual celebrity with us today.
Ooh.
This is great. Dr. Carrie Kane is with us. And Dr. Carrie Kane is an assistant professor for the Division of Public Health Pediatrics in the Department of Pediatrics at Baylor College of Medicine. She has her PhD in nursing and a Master of Public Health degree. She's also a BSN graduate from UT Arlington. Her research focuses on prevention of childhood adversity and injuries through addressing shared risk and protective factors. Dr. Kane, welcome to Behind the Scrubs. So can you tell us a little bit about your journey, your public health journey, like how you got to where you are today?
Sure. Actually, my public health journey started through nursing. Right here where we're at UTA, I am a UT Arlington, at the time it was the School of Nursing, alumni. I went to nursing school here, and really, my time at UTA was really formative and just opening up my eyes. I'd moved from a West Texas town out here to Arlington, and just the UTA is so international. Just walking from one end of campus to the other end of campus, could hear multiple languages, and just opened up my eyes to the world and to just being curious and interested in learning about other cultures. And so while I was here at UTA, went to nursing school at that time as well. The nursing school schedule, we didn't have the accelerated plan like y'all have now. And so I actually had summers off. And so through a student organization, it was a faith-based student organization here at UTA, I was able to spend my summers overseas on mission trips, and those trips really were transformative to, I think, my career trajectory and really moving me in to start thinking about public health, even though at the time I didn't know that was really a thing. I really just knew about nursing and what I was learning about nursing. But after I graduated from UTA, I worked at Children's Hospital in Dallas, and I was there for about a year. But through nursing school and even working in the hospital, like, I just knew that acute care nursing was not really where I was passionate. And I was applying that year to move overseas with an international mission sending agency. And after being a nurse for 1 year, I moved overseas to East Asia and worked there. I came in as a nurse and learning about the culture, learning about the people, about bringing in health clinics into this area. The people I worked with, it was a rural area. They were just a farming community and had a lot of health needs. In the clinics, we saw just a lot of preventable diseases and then just a lot of things that just really over years of just neglect. And just at the time, I didn't have the language to know it really, like, now that we are talking about social determinants of health, like really seeing how that impacted this community. But my work at that point, we were bringing in clinics, and as we were working with the people, we were helping treat their immediate needs right then and partnering with the government, which it brought a lot of recognition to the government to bring these clinics to help their people. But there was just something about it that was unsettling to me, where I felt like we weren't really helping with the long-term health of this population. And at the time, with just what I knew, really in nursing school, but I just had learned to take care of the patient in front of me and really did not know really how to look at a whole population of people and how do we impact the health of populations. And that's really where public health comes in. So at the time, I knew while I was there that I wanted to go back to school and get my master's in public health. And my hope at that point was that I would move back and really have more meaningful impact on the health of this population of people. So that's where my career started. And it's gone in lots of turns and twists.
That's really cool. I love that.
A lot of ways you can go there.
I got this. Okay. I'm super in love with rural health, right? I think that rural communities are so unique and they have these needs that we can definitely help with as an urban community, and we can help bring our resources into the rural communities. I have been to Southeast Asia, actually. I was there for 3 weeks and I got to go into some of the rural areas, and it's much different, right? And so it's interesting to hear that's where your love and your passion develops, because even in every country, their rural areas are different and their rural health needs are different. But Asia specifically, their lifespan is much shorter than in the U.S. And I love that you found your passion there, because ultimately you're right. Like, the government has to support all of the rural clinics going in and preventative medicine. And they have to support all of these things to really get to where they need to be. And I think that their lifespans have increased in the last probably 20 years or so. So that's really cool. And I love that's part of your story. So bringing it back to the U.S., so you came back, you were in Houston for your master's, right?
Yes.
Perfect. So then you completed your master's. And then where did you go from there? Like, how did you take that love for public health and how are you using it now?
Yeah. So bringing it even a little further back. So during my master's degree program, I was working. When I moved back, I came back and was an elementary school nurse. And that was perfect for while I was getting a master's in public health as well, because that type of nursing, you have this population of students in the school, but then you also have the surrounding neighborhood around that. But I think really good school nurses, like, there's so much that school nurses can do to really impact whole populations and really change the health trajectory for a lot of these kids. So in Houston, I worked at a school that was just north of downtown. It was just right in the urban center, a very low-income school, and I saw kids that were impacted by poverty, lots of symptoms of poverty, just seeing that every day with these kids and really working to try to connect them to resources, connect their families to resources, connect their families to job training. And there's so much more that nurses can do that we don't typically think about as like nursing. But anyway, so at that time I was getting my master's and just everything I was learning in class, like I was just eating it up and then going and applying it to my students there. And really just seeing where these kids were when they came in. So I had 3-year-olds up to 5th grade. And I just at that time could see that if we could only impact this family earlier, we could go back to before the child was born and supporting that mom and her partner and just really working with them so that these children had just such a more secure start in life. And so And that was the point that really piqued my interest in working in like maternal child health, working in early childhood development. And then from there with school nursing, actually, because that schedule is a 7 to 4 p.m. type of a job, I was getting my master's degree. So my last semester to graduate, I had some classes I had to take. And so I ended up actually having to step away from school nursing. And so for that next semester, I went back into acute care nursing and worked on a pediatric trauma floor where children that had been injured were coming in for surgery. And as I was working on that floor, again, I saw lots of, similar to it back in Asia, saw lots of preventable, at this point, and in illnesses that I saw in Asia, this time it was a lot of preventable injuries. These kids and the director knew that I was getting my master's in public health, and their hospital system had a pretty large trauma program, but they did not have a program for prevention of pediatric injuries. And as I was graduating, the director spoke with me and just said, I think this is public health. This is what you're getting your degree in. So I actually graduated and moved into a pediatric trauma injury prevention role there at the hospital and looking at the data and working to prevent childhood injuries, and focusing in Houston, but really looking at the data and looking at the evidence, what had been researched to be shown effective for prevention of injuries, and then trying to implement those things through our hospital system, through the resources that I can get through the hospital system.
So how did your experiences as a school nurse impact you in your career goals? What was it that you learned there that you've been able to apply to all of your work since then?
Yeah, I think just what I was saying before, you have this population of people. And so you really can look and see, and each population is unique. A lot of these kids were first generation in America. They, like I said, they lived in, now that neighborhood is completely different as to where it was before, but it just a changing neighborhood in downtown Houston. Working with them, I learned a lot, to be honest with you. And it was like some of it, I feel like I go home just really frustrated with just the system, frustrated with the barriers, especially just even accessing healthcare for these kids just to get immunizations. There just seemed to be, there's transportation barriers, monetary barriers. There is getting Medicaid and even getting on and maintaining their Medicaid coverage. It helped me to understand, again, I was learning all these different skills too as I was getting my master's degree, but to really understand how to look at a population, assess what their needs are, and look and find resources for them, or even just working with families and finding ways to connect them into programs within our community that could really help benefit both themselves and their child. But I'll say for like where I'm at right now, working with that population really moved me to want to start earlier and to start working with parents prenatal and really supporting them so that their kids have a more stable start in life. And that's where, for me, that's where that moved me.
A lot of what you've shared so far really talks about seeing a greater impact and trying to find the big picture. And it seems to have an interest in pursuing facts, the truth of things that are going on and the why of everything. So this is more of a philosophical question as we go on here, maybe, but how can a nurse, a lot of our listeners, a lot of our audience are nurses, how can a nurse benefit from having a greater understanding of public health, like getting formal training or education in public health in and of itself? How can that help your everyday bedside nurse?
Even if it's informal training.
Yeah, anything.
Yeah,
anything.
When a lot of schools, and I think probably y'all can plug UTA, you can get different certifications in public health.
We absolutely can. And there will be links and information in the episode.
Okay. But I do think that is a skill that is beneficial for all nurses, because in nursing, we have our patient population that we work with, and we will formulate our nursing care plan for how to care for that specific patient. And a lot of times we do think more on the individual level, looking at that individual patient, what symptoms they're presenting. And so along, it's like the nursing care model, not the model, but nursing is very holistic. And nurses do have a tendency, like, different than, I'm not putting down the medical model, but nurses do try to look at the whole. And so this is even going beyond that. And just thinking through, one thing that strikes me is we spend tons of money on medical care for these patients in the hospital, but then what environment are they going back to? And so thinking beyond just who's presenting to you right there whenever they walk in the door, but I think it's really important to understand what is their family dynamic, what is going on in their home, in their community that's impacting the health that's coming in, what has happened in their life. We think about trauma-informed care, and just that many people have been impacted by trauma. So whenever they walk in, not asking what's wrong with you, but really trying to understand what is the big picture, what has happened with you. I think these are all, they're parts of nursing, also parts of public health that are really important if we were to holistically really care for our patients.
Yeah, context matters. So I worked at one point in a juvenile detention center, and it was interesting because I would work with these youth and they'd successfully complete our program and go home to an environment that didn't improve. They may have improved and learned something about themselves or who they were or what led to their negative behavior, but then they go home and it's just those things reinforced everything. And so there's a lot of recidivism involved in that. So that's definitely something to consider, the big picture changes.
Yeah, and I think we see that a lot in rural communities too, right? Everybody knows everybody and they know each other. And so once you have this idea of somebody stuck in your head, say that they abuse alcohol, right? So you think of them, the community sees them as the kind of town alcoholic, so to speak. So they finally go and they get sober and they come back and there's still this stigma about how they are an alcoholic, right? And so it doesn't make it easy for them to go back to their home community and have that kind of weight on their shoulders. This brings us into kind of how you have gotten where you are right now. And so I want to talk a little bit about research, right? So you've been talking about how you noticed these things when you were working in these different systems, different areas, different communities. And you were like, okay, but I want to know the why, which is so important. And so that brings us to talking about some research that has been done with maybe teams that you've worked with. Do you do research yourself? Joe, just tell us a little bit about what you're interested in doing.
Yeah, so I am a research faculty at Baylor College of Medicine, and my team that I work with, I work with an amazing team of just multidisciplinary group of us who, on the clinical side of our team, we have pediatricians that work with children that have experienced adversity. And so they have experienced maltreatment. They have experienced being in the foster care system. And then moving on over, our medical director, Dr. Chris Greeley, he really is a visionary and really wanting to support systems that support healthy childhood development, prevention of child maltreatment, and really, really helping, as I mentioned, starting in the prenatal and supporting families to have a stable and thriving early childhood experience for their child. And so moving on the side that I am on, I'm on the public health side. And then on our side, we have both programs and research studies that are looking at early childhood. That really is our focus, prenatal up until around age 5 is really where our team, most of our research, now we have some outside of that, but most of our research focuses in on. And we use large data sets. We use hospital and merge some of our electronic medical records data just to try to understand and really define who is this population we're looking at that needs support, and just learning from that. But then we also have programs that we are working out in the community. And in those programs, we are evaluating their effectiveness. Also, for a year, we've been developing a new brief perinatal home visitation model that uses community health workers as the home visitors to go in the homes of families that are having a baby and starting prenatal and working with them up through 2 months post to really help connect and navigate these families to community resources, navigating them to also just really connecting them back in with their healthcare providers. Because a lot of times, especially for women, once they have their child, they don't take care of themselves and they don't usually go back to their postpartum visit. And that's very important. We know in Texas, especially, our maternal mortality rates are high. And so our community health workers, through this study, this program that we've developed, that's one of our goals, is connecting them back to their postpartum visits, to their pediatric visits for their children, and then working to address any barriers for healthcare, such as if they need food access, if they're food insecure, connecting them to resources in the community where they can have access to food. If they need employment, like helping them with job training opportunities. If they need transportation, working with them through what those transportation barriers and helping them with transportation. So we address a lot of their needs. But through this program, like right now, we've developed it. But we use the evidence that's been out there from other home visitation programs, have done interviews with with multiple people across the state of Texas that have been involved in home visiting, whether they're home visitors or participants in home visitation programs or supervisors, to learn from them what works, what doesn't work. And we put that the best in our model that we can learn from, and also just the needs of flexibility within programs. And we've spent a year building the model, and then we just now started 2 weeks ago recruiting, and our home visitors have had their initial visits with moms. And so we're studying that through our study design is a randomized control trial, and we're recruiting through an obstetric clinic in Houston. So right now, that is my main research focus, is to understand the effectiveness of this model compared to standard obstetric care of these home visitors going into the home. So we'll be measuring, are families more connected to resources? Does this impact the perinatal depression and stress levels of the moms that participate in the program compared to the comparison group? We're also looking at, does it change, or do moms have higher trust in institutions? Because this home visitor going into their home, hopefully, our hypothesis is that it would help build trust in other institutions as well. And so measuring that, those are our main outcomes that we're looking at for that study. But just trying to learn what works for who to support these families.
Amazing. If you'll just go back and explain to our listeners, like, what are community health workers and how are they being utilized to help some of these communities that we're in a nursing shortage. And so nurses are a great asset, but we just don't have enough of them. So how are we using these community health workers to really go out and be an essential part of the community to help?
Yeah. So our team at Baylor College of Medicine, in our Division of Public Health, Pediatrics, we love community health workers. We actually have on staff with our group, we have 3 community health worker instructors, but what they are, members of the community. And so that's one benefit, is our community health workers come from the community, and they know, like, they're familiar with resources in the community. They're familiar with the needs of the community, much more than someone like me that would come in as an outsider who has to come in and learn about the community. They come from the community. And so there's different training programs. I'm most familiar with the ones in Houston. There's 2 main, and I'm sure there's more than just the 2 in Houston, but in Houston, we have through University of Houston and then also through University of Texas Health Science Center. There in Houston, there are community health worker certification programs where community health workers learn about different health topics. And so one of our community health worker instructors, she likes to say that she's a grants community health worker, because really, for whatever grant she's being hired to work on, like, she just delves in and learns everything about that topic that she can learn, you know, and brings in her knowledge of how to support families and her knowledge of the community. They receive a lot of training in different techniques like motivational interviewing, different just effective behavior change techniques. Like, they've received education in that, and they're also required to do a certain amount of hours of continuing education too, similar to nursing in that sense, where we're always learning what works. For our program specifically, I mentioned the one research study that we're doing, and then we also have a few other maternal health supportive programs as well. And for those, we use community health workers to work with our families very closely to connect them. Their main thing is care coordination and connecting them to resources. We also just received funding through the state of Texas to expand some aspects of our programming that we're doing with families. One of the things I'm excited about with the expansion dollars is we will be working with a lot of times when you've had a baby and looking for employment, to think about how you're going to support yourself and the child. And so we actually, for some of our families, we'll have the opportunity for them to be certified and become certified community health workers. And so it's almost like job training and job employment support for some of our participants in our program as well, and giving them a skill that we find extremely valuable and useful. But that's how we've worked with community health workers. I'm sure that I'm not even doing it justice, but they really are the superheroes of really, like, our team and really helping to support our families.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, thanks for explaining that, because rural community health workers are a huge plus for us, because like you said, they're from that community. They know the population, and our rural communities in Texas, they're real close knit. It's everybody. You run into them at the grocery store and the doctor's office and all the things. So thank you for giving us the rundown. Jeff looks like he has a question.
I've got so many questions. So I think really looking at this, there's a few things here you mentioned already. I want to hear some more information about some of these programs you've done. Now, I can't remember if you shared this or not, but you're an expert in car seat safety.
That's true.
Okay.
Back in my injury prevention days, whenever I was doing the pediatric injury prevention, I became a certified child passenger safety technician because one of the leading causes of pediatric deaths are motor vehicle collisions. And for our youngest kids, if they're not in a car seat correctly installed in the vehicle, which most car seats are not correctly installed, if they get in a crash, they can be severely injured or die. And so, yeah, so there's in every community, I wouldn't say, I don't know if every, again, rural areas, there may be
unique.
There may not be this resource, but I do know that here in Tarrant County and also in Dallas County, there's a very strong car seat technician group through Safe Kids, Safe Kids in Tarrant County and Safe Kids in Dallas as well.
So what's the most common mistake people make putting in a car seat, do you think?
It's common mistake.
Yeah, according to research, I asked a researcher a question and she's going to say, I want to get a study, but for what you've seen.
Oh, a lot of times it's positioning the child in the car seat where they're like, one, the car seat's way too loose. It's not secured to the seat, but then the child is not secured to the car seat. And the positioning of the belts is usually off because these car seat manufacturers, they've done these crash tests, but it's when the seat is installed the way it's intended with physics. I'm looking at it. And so if we don't put our kids in the way that the manufacturer has tested it, then we're at risk of our kids being severely injured. And just also, I think that people move their kids to the front seat too soon, and I have lots of opinions on.
So it is funny to mention before to our listeners, I have twins, and when the twins were born, we had a Toyota Matrix. We were going to try and put these car seats in, and our listeners don't know this, but I'm a tall person.
Very tall.
And trying to squeeze myself in the back seat to try to get the car seats into the back seat of a Toyota Matrix was a fun experience.
Is that a two-door?
And it's a four-door hatchback, but it's tight.
Snug.
It's very snug.
See, and that's why if you go, these child passenger safety groups, they have inspection stations, and they'll look and see if you have, especially folks with twins, because sometimes it's hard to get two of them in, but they'll look at your vehicle, they'll look at the car seat and see how it's fitting and see, and such a little plug for our child passenger safety groups. But yeah, they look and actually see. And if you don't have a seat that is fitting in your vehicle, a lot of times they have grant funding where they're able to provide you with a proper seat or a few of the means, and they'll recommend what you can go and get. But they're a huge resource in communities that people, a lot of times people think, oh, I'm just going to take the fire department and get it inspected. But a lot of times the fire department is not certified child passenger safety technicians, so they have not received that training. So a lot of times that's not the place to go.
So I could have gotten a new seat. Instead, we switched to a minivan instead.
Oh, even better.
Yeah, I guess it was bound to happen eventually. But if it fit like a glove, I always got them locked in pretty well on the car seats.
I see that for you.
I feel like it does for the men. It ends up being just like this competition challenge because some of them can be so like complicated. But yeah, so I saw that whenever we were doing inspections. I'm no longer certified, so I'm not speaking as a currently certified technician. Just FYI, that has lapsed. That was in my past life.
I feel like I'm hearing like you have all these like small nuanced niche certifications and fun thing. I feel like you're a rabbit holer. You like hit something and you're like, oh my gosh, this is super interesting. I have to like dive super deep into this. So when we were talking earlier, you said that one of your current things is that you're looking at gun violence and how it affects pediatrics, children. And so do you want to talk a little bit about that? How you rabbit holed into this?
Sure. So this also came from my work. And so I'd mentioned just now we're talking about car seats. I had mentioned that one of the leading causes of death is motor vehicle collisions for children. But now the data is showing, and I have an article published on pediatric firearm prevention where we used CDC's national data set to look at, and then also just other studies that were published in the past 3 years, not mine, but other studies that have been published like in the Lancet or in the New England Journal of Medicine that highlighted to show that actually, sadly, firearm injuries are now the leading cause of injury-related death to children, whereas before it was motor vehicle collisions, but firearm injuries have now exceeded motor vehicle collisions. And see, we have these interventions like car seats that have really helped bring down motor vehicle collision rates. And with firearms, there are also things that we can do to keep our kids safe, such as safe storage of firearms. And so I was on a CDC grant. One of my colleagues at Baylor College of Medicine, she's a trauma surgeon and has operated on many children that have suffered from devastating firearm injury wounds. And just through her work, and she is very passionate about preventing this, so she received funding from the CDC for us to collect data on all pediatric firearm, actually it was pediatric and adult. My focus was more on the pediatric population, but pediatric firearm injuries in Harris County, which is the county, the largest county in Texas, that Houston's in. And so we developed a linked data set, both electronic medical records from the level one trauma centers there, linking those to the Institute of Forensic Sciences, which is our medical examiner, their records, and then also linking to police data, so that we can better understand some of the risk factors for firearm injuries. And so the study, the data is from, we collected data from 2018 to 2020 and are analyzing that data to really understand some of the risks. And my interest really in that is in some of these for our younger kids. A lot of them are injured, we call it unintentional. And so that's where typically a firearm is not secured in the home. And I would say if there's a firearm in the home, that child is at more risk of being injured from a firearm injury. A lot of times people would say that it makes you safer. I think for children, it does not make them safer in the home. And so I definitely believe that securely and safely storing your firearms, if you choose to have one in the home, especially if you have children, or if you have other people that may be at risk for injuring themselves or harming others, it's very important to make sure that the firearms are secured where they do not have access to those things.
Sure. I'll go ahead and say that this is not to say that she is not advocating for taking away your firearms. Don't worry. But I think she is advocating for gun safety, which I think is very appropriate when we talk about things like this. And clearly the data shows that as well. I'm curious, you said that you guys look at multiple reports from different areas, your medical examiner and the police. Do the police have a checkbox for unintentional or intentional that you guys get to look at?
For that, and the police data, a lot of it was narrative data. And so we had a large study team, primarily made up of medical students. And so they delved into the data. So what they did was actually look through and read the reports of all the different sources that we had. So those three that we linked together. And then in the end, so we did find, and actually we are working on getting a paper published on the discrepancies in what people called the type of injury. And so, because that's important for us who use data to really make, whether it's policy recommendations or for further research and just better understanding what the problem is. But there was a team of three researchers that came together in the end that would look to see, okay, these three called, this is what they said were the details of this injury event that happened. And so we came together and had consensus on whether it was a homicide or an assault is what we call it, or an unintentional injury, or so we have a bystander category of folks that that one is not always coded in the trauma registry. It was another part of the electronic records, like in the trauma registry. And then unclear, because sometimes you're just not clear what the intent was and when in self-harm or suicide. Wow. Those are the main categories that we found. But because some would call it differently on those things, so we brought together all three, looked at it as a whole, and then we made the final call. And then if we differed, then we'd have to come to consensus.
Yeah, thanks for walking us through that. That's really interesting.
So you mentioned several programs before we got started, things that you're involved with, whether on the research side or community service side. Can you just walk us through what some of those programs are and how that might be beneficial for some of our listeners?
And how they can access them.
Sure. So through Baylor College of Medicine, our team, our Division of Public Health Pediatrics, as I mentioned, we feel like having a strong start in life is very important. I had mentioned the research study that I was doing with the new perinatal home visitation model using community health workers. But we also have programs that we offer in the community. And those are, we study those as far as for program evaluation. And so that there's not like a control group and an intervention group. It's not a rigorous study. We are studying just certain outcomes of the program through program evaluation. But we have what's called our Upstart Community Model. That's the umbrella term of the programs that we have. And again, these are operated by my amazing colleagues at Baylor College of Medicine. But we have one program, it's called Uplift, and that is a perinatal mood disorder program for moms, prenatal or postpartum, that are experiencing postpartum or perinatal depression or anxiety. And it's a home visitation program where we have social workers that will go into the home, and they have many modules that they can work with. And the mom, really, the program is flexible where the mom chooses really what modules they are interested in working on with the social workers. And so we feel like addressing the mental health needs of women that are either pregnant or postpartum is extremely important, both for that mom and also preventing maternal mortality and self-harm and suicide. Unfortunately, that is one of the main causes of maternal mortality. But then also having a mom that is able to be healthy, to engage in their child, and really having that attachment and bonding. We know that postpartum depression and anxiety can impact that. And so it's such a key time in the life of brain development for that child. And so that's why, one of the reasons why we're passionate about having that program to support women. That program is offered in the greater Houston region. And so that's where Baylor College of Medicine is located, in Houston. We also have our Upwards program, which that program is for parents that have a child from birth to age 3. And that is our early brain development program. So I alluded to that with Uplift, but Upwards really focuses on helping parents with engaging their child in their language development and reading to their child, singing to their child, playing with their child, and really building that important attachment and bond, that also this interaction is building their child's brain. So through that program, we use, it's called the Lena Start curriculum, and we have it's almost the size of a credit card, a little bit thicker. But it's a device that once a week participants will wear, or their children, actually, the child will wear a little vest, and they put it in the vest, and it records the language interaction between the parents and the child. And so parents each week get a handout, in a sense, but it has graphs on it, and it shows the amount of adult words that are spoken to the child during the day, the amount of, we call them conversational turns, back and forth interaction between parent and child, which those interactions, studies have shown, are really critical for brain activation and for brain development for these young children. And then the amount of time the child is exposed to television or audio electronics. And really, you can see these inverse relationships between, if television time's high, adult words and conversational turns are low. When television time is low, then usually adult words and conversational turns are high. So families once a week will do those recordings, and then they get this information, and it really helps them to push them in increasing their interactions with their children. They also receive a library of 16 age-appropriate books for them to encourage them to read with their child. And so that's a 3-month program. That one we have in-person in Houston groups that are just now starting back up. We moved to virtual during the pandemic and have stayed with that, but just now are starting to move back to having some in-person groups. It's a group-based program, but we actually offer that virtually. And so anyone that is interested in that program can access it. And so I can give information if you'd like to put it in the notes of the podcast. And then we have our, it's called our Upreach Plus program, but that one is similar to the model that I'm studying. We have another model that pairs, that works in Houston with a high-risk obstetric clinic, their patients, and that model pairs a community health worker with a nurse, and they work with pregnant and postpartum women that have high-risk conditions. So
amazing. We'll put a link in for more information on these three different programs. Thank you for walking us through each of them. I'm really excited to have that as a resource for our listeners. And even for those that are listening out of state, I'm sure that there are resources, maybe not the same, but similar. You just have to do some digging, but we would be happy to help you guys if needed. So if you want to reach out to us, Jeff and I would be happy to look into some resources for you guys.
Absolutely.
To wrap things up, you guys know that I love talking about advocacy, okay? So I have to talk about it. So I'm sure that you know how important advocacy is. And like we've talked about before, advocacy is really can be done in 50 different ways. So tell us a little bit about how you advocate and how important it is to advocate for these health concerns, health issues that you see.
Yeah, I think advocacy is very important. Policies can really advance health of populations, or they can harm health of populations. And so it is important for us to be good partners with those that have legislative authority over, whether it's working with the local government or with state or even federal. I've worked as a private citizen, a passionate nurse, and public health professional. I have gone to the Capitol in Austin and set up meetings with our representatives, our senators. And so a lot of times I end up meeting with their staffers and trying to really provide them with the evidence or with whatever I'm concerned about, especially with pediatric injury prevention, with early childhood well-being, maternal child health. These are all topics that I'm very passionate about. And most legislative sessions, I will go to Austin at least once just to share and be a part. Another way is just reaching out to your representatives in the off, kind of I call it the off season, but like right now they're trying to get reelected in some of them. And so sometimes that can be busy, but just being a resource for them, knowing that they can go to you on these certain topics and things. Also, part of my service is I am on the Governor's EMS and Trauma Advisory Council's Injury Prevention and Public Education Committee. And so it's a group we meet quarterly, and a statewide group of just multidisciplinary, primarily healthcare sector, it's EMS and trauma. And so, but just through that group with our Injury Prevention Committee, similar to what I've talked about before, we look at the data statewide, look at the evidence, and really trying to promote policies and programs and practices statewide that would promote the health. And so in those specifically prevention of injuries, but of our population. And so trying to work to help promote those policies. A lot of times it depends on which agency you work for. So a lot of times you may not be able to go in and under the name of that agency, but you can always, as a private citizen, talk to your policymakers, let them know what resources you have, and just helping to enlighten them on especially the evidence, or also if you have stories, they like stories.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us today, and thanks for talking to us about all of your experiences and your variety of interests. We love to hear it. But yeah, thank you for telling our listeners about the importance of public health as a whole and how you got into it. It's always interesting, Jeff. I feel like we hear all these different perspectives of how people ended up in public health. I feel like a lot of them fell into it.
Right. It's never factory. It's never just down the line.
Right.
Dr. Kane, thank you for being out behind the scrubs.
Thanks for having me.
So Aspen, what did you think?
She's great. Obviously, she's super intelligent. She's really passionate about her field. I really love that she's a rabbit holer, because so am I. So that's appreciative for me. I really enjoyed how I think public health, and the more that we listen to these guests, the more I'm realizing that like public health really is like a conglomeration of all of healthcare. There's just so many like avenues that public health deals with and handles and advocates for that I think are really interesting. So I think my favorite part was just hearing really about how even in big cities, they're struggling with a lot of the same issues that rural communities are. My focus is obviously on rural. And so a lot of the times I like urban's kind of to the wayside for me. But hearing about how urban communities still struggle with poverty, transportation, a lot of the issues that are big in the rural communities brings me back to say that it's a holistic healthcare problem. It's not necessarily just rural, just urban. And I think that's important to think about as we move on and continue with our guests on this podcast.
Absolutely. Two things. One, you accuse me of making up words. Well, you're just saying a rabbit hole.
Sometimes you do make up words.
That's a thing that
exists. That's a real word. Okay.
We'll go with it. I'll accept it. That's fine. The second thing is, I could be completely biased here, but this is my absolute favorite guest.
I wonder why.
I've ever had or ever will have.
Why is this your favorite guest?
Full disclosure here, maybe this should have been at the beginning of the podcast, but we'll put it here instead. I'm fortunate enough to have been married to Dr. Kane for some time now, and Carrie's great, and she's awesome, and she is objectively better than me in every single way.
I can confirm that. Yeah, and that's guaranteed.
The only thing I've got on her is I'm taller.
That's true.
It's just everything else is fantastic. And so I've loved getting to hear her story and getting to share it, because she does a lot of wonderful work and is going to continue to contribute in a meaningful way for many years to come.
I personally am appreciative. Jeff actually asked her a couple of weeks ago if she was interested in being on our podcast, and she said yes. So I'm very appreciative that she said yes in the first place, because Jeff and I have actually talked about her being a guest on our podcast for a little bit now. So I really enjoyed it. So with that being said, thanks to everybody for listening to this episode of Behind the Scrubs today.
Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
To keep up with UT Arlington's College of Nursing and Health Innovation and its various programs, visit us online or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter at UTA Con High. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye, y'all.